ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's a sound you might recognise, not from real life, but from the big screen. What you can hear there is the sound of an enormous T-Rex on the loose and on the hunt. Even though it's all thanks to the creative genius of the Jurassic Park audio effects team, it still sends shivers up your spine. Since its release in 1993, Jurassic Park has terrified and excited millions of fans around the world. And for a group of teachers turned amateur filmmakers in regional Victoria, it's also inspired the remake project of a lifetime. We'll take you there shortly. And while they're working on that passion project, there are growing concerns that there won't be enough qualified workers more broadly to support Australia's booming film and television industries. I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country, Perth. Around the country, like many people, university students are desperately trying to make ends meet. Rents are up, along with grocery prices, fuel, and just about every other living expense. For many, a study requirement to work the equivalent of 6 months full-time without pay is just not an option. However, that's the current state of play for many uni students in fields like nursing, teaching, and social work. In order to graduate, they need to fulfil unpaid prac placements, which can be up to 1,000 hours. Student advocates have long been pushing for change, which may at last be realised. The federal government has announced it will be establishing a new means-tested payment for students with mandatory prac. To the tune of roughly $320 per week, it's hoped the payment will provide some relief to students struggling financially. Professor Christine Morley joins me on this. She is the head of the Social Work and Human Services discipline at Queensland's University of Technology, and she has seen how this issue impacts her own students. Hi, Christine. What was your initial reaction to this announcement that the government will establish a new payment for uni students on prac?
It's certainly a welcome announcement. It shows that the University Quad Review Panel and the Minister of Education, Jason Clare, and Prime Minister Albanese have listened to students, they've listened to the research evidence, they have recognised placement poverty as an issue that needs to be addressed, and even though it's not all that we had hoped for, it will make a big difference for the students that are eligible.
We're hearing that term placement poverty being used a lot in relation to this issue. You just used it there. From your experience working in the field, what are the realities of placement poverty? What does it look like for students in that situation?
We know that students have had to give up work in order to do placements. From our survey, a staggering 96% of students said that they didn't actually have money for food or for medications, basic necessities. We know that students were choosing between food and petrol in order to go to placement, disconnecting their phone and their bills, giving up rental properties, or going into sort of massive debt. Or there's this other cohort of students who are just simply working a lot of hours on top of their placement. So they're the students who are exhausted, fatigued, you know, driving Ubers at night or cleaning rooms and before placement in the morning. And, you know, they're absolutely exhausted and not able to learn properly.
Does placement poverty affect regional and remote students perhaps more significantly than some of their metro peers?
Yeah, look, placement poverty affects everyone, or certainly a lot of students. We have, you know, students from disadvantaged backgrounds in social work, in nursing and teaching as well. We have highly feminised professions. We also have students with, disabilities and students with, First Nations students. So students who are vulnerable to poverty anyway, but, you know, regional and rural students are definitely part of the demographic that, you know, can be more disadvantaged, and also students who have to go, like, leave metropolitan areas to go and do placements in rural and regional areas. We hear from those students as well, and that obviously makes placement a lot more expensive with travel costs, or perhaps trying to, you know, keep their mortgage but have to pay rent on a place, so that they can access their placement, all those kinds of things. So, yeah, they are disadvantaged definitely more than other students.
Have you seen the current system of large prac requirements with no additional financial support, have you actually seen it stopping students from graduating in their desired field, from them actually withdrawing from a course?
Yeah, absolutely. I have seen that. I've seen students who are desperately wanting to qualify as social workers have to give up their dream because they just can't afford to do the placement. And that's been really devastating, of course. In our survey, I think it was 80% of students had known other students who had had to defer their studies or drop out, which is pretty high.
So what then are the flow-on effects for the workforce with this?
Yeah, well, we know that unpaid placements has acted as a disincentive to attract students into doing vital professions like nursing, teaching and social work. We know that the placements have caused students to drop out or to defer their studies. And so, if we have some financial support for students, then obviously they're more likely to succeed in their degrees, they're more likely to graduate. The unpaid placements are absolutely implicated in workforce shortages, so we would hope that this measure does go some way towards addressing those workforce shortages by supporting students to be actually able to complete their degrees.
Could this help get more qualified graduates out into regional areas where professions like teaching and social work are so desperately needed?
Put it this way, if we didn't do something to address this crisis, the workforce shortages that are projected will mean that we'll have schools without teachers and hospitals without nurses, and we won't have adequate social workers to respond to domestic violence or, work in aged care or child protection, very important sort of roles that they're doing. So we desperately needed the government to hear what these concerns were, and I do believe that they have listened and gone some way towards addressing that. So I do think it will help to bring, graduates into regional and rural areas.
Earlier on, you mentioned that it perhaps wasn't everything you'd hoped for, though you do welcome the announcement. So what further action then is needed?
Well, I suppose we were really hoping that it wouldn't be a means-tested system. We were hoping that it would be seen as payment for work. And I suppose when you're doing a job and you're doing sort of paid employment, people don't look in your bank account to see, whether or not you collect your wage for the week. The danger with a means-tested benefit is that, some students just simply won't apply for it because administratively it might be too complex. Some students will still fall through the gaps, even though they might still be in need. I haven't seen the detail around it, but I would hope it doesn't exclude international students, but international students are currently not eligible for any kind of government support. So if it's going to be administered by Centrelink, I imagine that they're not going to be eligible, and we do need those international students to fill those workforce shortages and to be completing their degrees. So that's all, I guess, a risk factor for it. The other things, of course, is if it's tied to the amount of Centrelink payment, we know that that's grossly inadequate to support students. We know that we haven't seen a significant increase in Austudy, for example, payments since about 1994, and we know inflation has spiralled out of control in the last several years since COVID. So, with a payment that's not indexed, that doesn't include superannuation and all of those kinds of things, it has limitations. But, it's still better than nothing.
Professor Christine Morley has been speaking to me here on Australia-wide. Christine, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. Right now, Australia is going through a film and TV production boom. It's great news for the industry. But there are calls for greater investment in Australian film crews so that there are enough workers to meet demand ahead of local content quotas being placed on streaming services. The Australian government is currently reviewing the National Cultural Policy to impose a quota for major streaming platforms to invest revenue into producing local content from mid-2024. It's hoped that changes will improve confidence in the local industry and provide more long-term stability for Australian productions. The screen industry is currently pushing for a 20% quota, but one of the country's leading directors has questioned whether there are currently enough crews and qualified film and TV production workers in the country to benefit from such a change. Our reporter Peter Sanders has more.
Thornfield is a flower farm, but it's also a safe place for women to come and to heal. And all of your poking about with police and lawyers puts all of it at risk.
At the moment, if you get a show up and you have to get a crew together, it's kind of like the Hunger Games. Like, you're out there fighting to try and find crew.
Yeah. When award-winning film director Glendon Ivan was given the green light in 2021 to create the streaming TV series The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, he struggled to find local Australian film crews to help in production. This was despite big names like Sigourney Weaver and Asha Keddie leading the cast and being fully funded from streaming service Amazon Prime.
We had to bring in people from New Zealand and other places because there's so much production happening in Australia.
He questions how the Australian film industry will be able to respond to federal government changes to the National Cultural Policy, which will impose a quota for major streaming platforms to invest revenue into producing local content from mid-2024. While the details are yet to be finalised, Ivan said Australia currently did not have enough film crews to fully benefit from the 20% quota being pushed for by the screen industry. He believes more local investment is needed in the industry.
I'd like to see some money put into training and development. Whenever I talk to people, particularly students, about what would you like to be in the film industry, everyone wants to be a director or producer, maybe a cinematographer, but there's so many other roles and they're just not seen as attractive or viable things. Mm. If I was coming up in the film industry and I wasn't hell-bent on being a director, I'd be a sound person or a lighting person or hair and makeup or any of the hundreds of jobs. Tony Burke's doing a great job in trying to get the streamers to pay a 20% quota. I'd like to see him bring in like an apprenticeship scheme in the film industry, like kind of in the building industry, or build more studios because we don't really have much studio space in Australia.
Some streaming services have limited the amount of Australian productions they are commissioning until the quota is known. Ivan believes the services are nervous about being regulated for investing in Australian content, something many are already doing.
What I think the government's trying to do is regulate it so we can bet, like in 5 years' time or in 10 years' time, it's still happening. Because there's no guarantee at the moment. I hope that the streamers, without being regulated, just go, look, it's really great. We're making great programs. For example, Lost Flowers is an Australian production. Mm. It was launched around the world when it was released. It was in the top five of 70 countries, and I think in the top three of 40 countries. Like, it outperformed what they were expecting. So we know that if we make good programs in Australia, they will travel and will stand up just against any other show around the world.
University of Technology Sydney Media and Arts Production Program lecturer Matthew Dabner said pandemic-related stimulus from the Morrison government triggered a sugar hit of content from the Australian screen industry. An Australian Bureau of Statistics survey showed industry investment reached $4.6 billion in the 2021-22 financial year, more than doubling the 5 years prior.
That was amazing. There was a period, you know, in 21-22 where they could not find enough workers to do the jobs that we had. That has come off the boil now. So anecdotally, I'm hearing that things have contracted significantly.
Mr. Dabner said a streaming quota could renew confidence in the local industry and trigger another surge of production. He said UTS is seeing a steady increase in the number of students studying film and believe they were nearly at the point they could quickly turn around new professionals if needed.
What we know about the industry is that it's really responsive to stimulus. So when situations come along like the potential quota, they will be able to respond quickly to finding the people needed to kind of support that kind of industrial activity. We are able to service them, and it will require just a small uplift in terms of the training and the skills.
Rulings in the National Culture Policy dictate what types of program formats contribute to the quotas. Mr. Dabner said broadcasters under the policy were required to portion time between scripted dramas, documentary and children's programs.
And some of those rules were relaxed during the pandemic, in particular with children's programming for our free-to-air broadcasters, and that has seen a precipitous drop-off in the amount of children's programming that we are making. It really does have to be supporting the kinds of formats that need the support and need that extra lift across the finish line.
Peter Sanders with that report on the growing demand for film crew workers as the country's film and television industry booms. And speaking of local film productions, it doesn't get much more local than this. In regional Victoria, a group of friends are nearing the end of a colossal project, a shot-by-shot remake of Jurassic Park. It started as a way to blow off steam after stressful days in the classroom. But 2.5 years down the track, these teachers turned amateur filmmakers now have an entire crew behind them. Yes, they're actually able to source a film crew. And as they've discovered, recreating a blockbuster with little to no budget presents some dinosaur-sized challenges. Central Victorian reporter Tyrone Dalton has this story.
There's movie-making magic happening in the regional Victorian town of Castlemaine, but it's got nothing to do with the gold rush the town is well known for. This time, it's dinosaurs, and a fan remake of the 1993 film Jurassic Park. Here's one of its filmmakers, John Rober.
I need more directions, guys.
We're trying to film at as many sort of iconic places around Castlemaine as possible. I mean, it's taken us to these tunnels under Castlemaine and sort of Lot 19, this, you know, famous place in Castlemaine that has a lot of events. The outback of the theatre doubled for Costa Rica. We're trying to get as much of Castlemaine as possible. We're trying to make the cast exclusively Castlemanians.
It was 31 years ago when Hollywood director Steven Spielberg brought the fictional island of Isla Nublar and its dinosaurs to life in the blockbuster film Jurassic Park. And now, with no budget and a crew of volunteers, it's being remade in central Victoria, scene by scene, shot by shot.
I was spitballing ideas with a colleague, ways we could take our mind off the fact that we were a little bit miserable at work. And I think she suggested knitting. And I said to her something along the lines of, that sounds really boring. Why don't we do a shot-for-shot remake of Jurassic Park? Honestly, the question I get asked the most is, why am I doing this? I think I'm someone who does things without thinking a lot. And I've spent the last 2.5 years trying to find an answer as to why I'm doing this. I haven't found it. I'm still thinking about it. And potentially there will never be a concrete why.
That was John Roebuck, a teacher from Castlemaine in regional Victoria. By day, Jen O'Donnell is also a teacher, but on her weekends, she transforms into Dr. Ellie Sattler.
Our friend John had an idea to make this movie and signed us all up, and that was nearly 2 years ago. There were a group of us, and I remember saying, oh, can I be Laura Dern? And I was joking. And he said, yes. I thought, oh, that'd be fun.
But taking on a low-cost remake of Jurassic Park means finding ways to recreate prehistoric reptiles. John Roebuck explains.
We've got this sort of T-Rex puppet you can see here. We've got a raptor head. But a lot of the stuff, we're actually just using green screen animations and we're just taking out the green.
And with no money to spend, remaking Jurassic Park has meant shooting on cold nights and moments of DIY ingenuity. Special effects have developed considerably since the 90s, but not in this remake. They're using the same kind of technology Spielberg used.
Jurassic Park was released in 93, and that was sort of the nascent period of CGI sort of really coming to the fore in Hollywood. And so a lot of films nowadays, you know, blockbuster films will have thousands of effect shots with CGI. And I think Jurassic Park only has about 60 or something.
Beginning as a cast of few and with non-existent filmmaking skills, the number of people behind the remake has grown. About 100 people have joined up, learning about the film as shoots take place around Castlemaine.
We started off without a cameraman and we were just filming with a borrowed camera, and then we got a cameraman and then we got another one. Now we have 3 cameramen and we have these vehicles and they're amazing because people just own Jurassic Park vehicles.
Ian Flavell is a local builder, but for the past 2.5 years, his weekends see him playing the role of paleontologist Dr. Alan Grant.
I mean, I think that's the best thing about acting, is just the opportunity to be a different character, experience a different emotion, express in a different way.
It's this sort of passion that has Australians exploring ways of showing their love for movies, television shows and comic books. Peter Pascoe runs Bendicon, a comic convention in the regional city of Bendigo. Now in its 10th year, it's one of a few comic conventions in regional Australia.
You follow your passion is basically what being a fan means. My passions lie in the realm of pop culture. I've been a comic fan for a very long time, music fan for a very long time. You'll find people out there that are into the weirdest and wonderfulest things.
Peter Pascoe says it's this shared love that creates and promotes community.
Fan remakes of popular movies have been around for quite a long time. It's really a chance for people who loved the movie to feel as though they're a part of it.
With jeep chases, dinosaurs and electric fences all to be filmed, it's the remake's crew of workmates, friends and one-time strangers that have made it possible.
It just gets better and better in terms of quality, which as tiring and stressful as it is, it sort of gets addictive.
Oh,
well, we're being checked by T-Rex, guys.
That was John Roebuck and the crew behind the fan remake of Jurassic Park, ending that story by Tyrone Dalton. And you can see the filmmakers in action by heading to the ABC News website. Just search for ABC News and you can watch and read about the story there. And finally, here on Australia Wide, nothing illustrates the phrase dogs are a man's best friend quite like watching a border collie round a herd of cattle into the next paddock. So with ongoing workforce shortages across the country, it's no surprise that the popularity of working dogs is on the rise. Highly trained dogs are helping to fill these labour gaps for farmers. But for a worker this efficient, you can expect a hefty price tag. From Central Queensland, reporter Aaron Kelly has this story.
Border collies Buck and Rebel don't shy away from hard work. They run all day herding cattle into their pens and keeping them in check. It's clear from watching them that as farmers around the country grapple with workforce shortages, these are the most efficient workers in the industry.
Not through any fault of anybody, but there's just a bit of a lack of workforce that we're finding in the bush these days. And I think, you know, with the inception of a lot more people starting to use working dogs, they're becoming a valued part of the team.
That's Central Queensland grazier David Steele. He runs a 4,000-hectare cattle operation with his wife Kelly at Bohinia, southwest of the beef capital, Rockhampton. The couple's team of working dogs, led by Buck and Rebel, are integral to their day-to-day life on the land.
We couldn't do our job without them. They make it so much easier, just Dave and I doing the mustering. And they certainly make it easy. They're definitely worth every penny. A good dog is worth two men.
As farmers struggle to find workers across Australia, many are turning to man's best friend to get the job done. Livestock manager and long-time cattleman Gary Went knows all too well the value a well-trained working dog brings to any farming operation.
Work off what I do, or a few contractors that I know do, you know, like their dogs, they're their workforce. So they get up of a morning, saddle their horse, ride out with five or six or seven dogs, whatever they need, and go around the paddock. They might have a helicopter in the sky, runs it into them, or whatever, but they're just workers, really, because it's, as we all know, it's hard to get workers. It doesn't matter whether you're running a cafe or a property, it's hard to get workers, and they assist with that. Makes it a lot easier.
It can be a bit rough and tumble for working dogs who are on the front line from sun up to sundown.
It's not all beer and Skittles, that's for sure, like that, yeah. And you put sort of, you know, 15 to 20 kilos a dog up against hundreds of kilos of a beast, and most of the time, if it gets a bit rough, they come off second best. But, yeah, you know, like, you can't fault them, eh? Like, they'll give you their heart, and they'll just keep fronting up for sure.
A tri-collar female border collie sold for a whopping $40,000 at a Central Queensland working dog trial and sale, which wrapped up on Sunday. The record-breaking sale surpassed the Guinness World Record for a working border collie, a dog in the UK named Kim, which sold for nearly $39,000 in 2021.
And as far as dog prices go these days, I think it's sort of got to the point where people are really starting to realise that a good work dog can do a lot for you, and they're prepared to pay for them too, you know, which is good. I mean, like, we've sort of, yeah, they've been cheap enough for long enough, I think.
The ABC TV series Muster Dogs recently put working dogs and their tireless efforts in the spotlight. Winton's Carey Prandolini joined long-term friend Steve Elliott in the latest season of Muster Dogs, with lucrative mining jobs luring away workers who might otherwise have been part of a new generation of farmers. She says border collies like her trusty companion Slim are stepping up to the job.
Yeah, super important, especially at the moment with it like harder to find workers, I guess. Younger people seem to be going to the mines and so forth, and to have dogs to help you, it's, they're priceless.
Working dog trials and sales like the one held in Central Queensland each year are not only now fetching big bucks, but they're gaining popularity from all over the country.
Tasmania, and there was an island just off Tasmania, another one went to, usually up to Laura. We've had three dogs go to Laura last year, which is up in the Cape. Yeah, as far west as Hewenden, yeah, and then back down into New South Wales, scattered around New South Wales. You know, it's very good. It's been accepted by a lot of people to come and have a look at the dogs we got up here.
That's Central Queensland livestock manager and longtime cattleman Gary Wendt. Ending that story from Capricornia reporter Aaron Kelly. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. Thanks so much for your company. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.